Well, we've had sessions where we've had debated an empty chair before, but I didn't quite know how we could figure out how to have two empty chairs debate each other. So, greetings. This afternoon, we're here to talk about a different topic. We're here to talk about sunshine and whether you can get too much of it. You've already heard who I am. I'm the Environment Beat reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I'm also chair of SEJ's Freedom of Information Task Force. Next year, in case you aren't already aware, it's the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Freedom of Information Act, which inspired similar open records laws in almost all the other 50 states. But there's a brewing debate in some circles about whether open records laws are being abused to silence scientists who publish inconvenient research or take public stances on controversial topics. Some are suggesting it's time to restrict certain records requests. This is serious stuff. To many SEJers and journalists in general, freedom of information is kind of like the 11th commandment or the 11th amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But there's been a string of news stories in the past year about how scientists and other academics are working or speaking out on hot topics like climate change and genetically engineered foods have hidden ties to industry or to advocacy groups. Those stories were driven or inspired in many instances by open records requests filed by activists looking for previously undisclosed financial support or other evidence of coordination. There are some of those should be posted online on our website. Scientists and those supportive of their research or stances have complained about those requests, which have required the review and release of thousands of documents, including email communications with other scientists, with outside groups and individuals. The critics say they're a form of harassment, meant to intimidate or tie up researchers so they'll be prevented or shy away from doing any further research or making any more public statements opposed by those filing the records requests. For the next 40 minutes now, maybe a little more, we're going to explore this issue of whether one can have too much sunshine and how, if at all, one can shield from scrutiny the work of scientists without losing vital transparency. Joining me is a panel representing some of the varying views in this debate. And it's a complex one. We've talked about it a lot in the 2 weeks we've pulled this together. I'm going to spare the lengthy introductions. You can look them up online in the interest of time, but I'll just briefly run through them. We have Catherine Hayhoe, climate scientist at Texas Tech, who's been on the receiving end of demands to see her emails and a lot more. Next, Michael Halperin, program manager for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington. Then we have Gary Ruskin, co-director of U.S. Right to Know, a nonprofit group that has filed records requests to learn about undisclosed ties with the food industry. Finally, our panel includes Mike Sorahan, reporter with Energy Wire, who's used open records himself in reporting. Now, we're not here to debate climate change or the safety of GMO foods. Instead, we're going to focus on the use of open records laws by those engaged in those issues and others. And as a ground rule, panelists have all agreed, since we only have less than an hour now to cover a topic we could easily spend a day on, we're going to try, and I'm going to insist, that we keep our answers brief and to the point. So, Dr. Hayhoe, a few years back, you received a request from a group known as the American Tradition Institute, demanding to see email communications and other records?
Yes.
Tell me about it. Tell us about it.
Sure. I received several requests, and I was one of quite a few scientists who received these requests. Every month, it seems like, I would get an email from another colleague saying, hey, I just got one of these. What do I do? Why were they so disturbing to us? They didn't come from a journalist seeking information. They came from an organization which we now know was being paid by a coal company specifically to send these requests. And the requests were not simple requests for emails. In fact, they were not requests at all. They were statements of the crimes that we had committed, ending with an announcement that they were seeking the proof so that we could be appropriately prosecuted. In other words, we had already been judged and determined to be guilty, and they only needed the evidence before they could do what they, you know, needed to do. So as an innocent academic researcher being called up on the phone by the lawyers for your university. Lawyers never like to put anything in email, so you get a phone call from a lawyer. It's the first time they've ever talked to you. They're not happy to be talking to you because you've just made more work for them. It's not a very pleasant situation to be in, especially if you're a faculty member who doesn't yet have tenure. And so you go through this whole thing of looking at all your emails, making sure you get all of them, having a third person look through them. It takes an enormous amount of time and effort. And in the end, nothing came out of it. Not for myself, not for any of my colleagues, because we had not committed the crimes that we were being accused of. But there was certainly...
Did you turn over records?
Of course.
How many?
We turned over as many as we could find. And in Texas, our lawyers, for example, recommended redacting any intellectual property relating to unpublished work. Well, that went up to the Attorney General's office, and they said, no, you have to give them everything they ask for. So they got all full uncensored emails that they
requested. Including things you had not yet published.
Correct.
That might be scooped by somebody else.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And how many pages do you think it was?
Goodness. It wasn't as many as they probably hoped, because they're asking for specific terms, and I just don't keep a lot of emails. On things like that. But they got everything there was.
Okay.
And then the next thing that comes back is another accusation about something different. And then they just kind of kept coming back until they kind of figured, well, she's a dead end. Let's go to the next person.
So that was your one bout with the open records?
Multiple.
But it had multiple stages.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Now, of course, you received a lot of other... You received some emails yourself, correct?
Some emails?
Yeah.
You're talking about nasty emails or regular emails?
I think that's what I was referring to.
Yes, many of those.
Right.
They didn't ask about those. I was a little disappointed.
They didn't?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did they ask you for in their requests or in their demands for your records?
The first demand came after it was became known during the last GOP primaries that I had written a chapter for a book that was going to be edited by Newt Gingrich. It was for a book that would be published by John Hopkins Press, which is an academic publisher.
I think I've heard of them.
Yeah, exactly. But they were concerned that I had used university resources to write this academic chapter. And so they wanted evidence that I had misused university resources, which it turned out I hadn't, because I wrote it on my personal computer, on my personal time.
And so that was the focus of the...
That was the first one. They also wanted to know my connection to the Union of Concerned Scientists. And various other connections to people like Seth Borenstein and other disreputable journalists probably sitting in this room.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Michael Halpern. It isn't just climate scientists who are being peppered with these record requests, is it?
No, it's not just climate scientists. You know, I've been... This kind of came up for the Union of Concerned Scientists back when Michael Mann was being investigated by the Attorney General of Virginia. And after that point, when he started losing in court, the American Tradition Institute took up the Attorney General's call to arms and asked for the same exact information through the Virginia FOIA. That went through the courts over the course of 18 months or 2 years. And the Virginia Supreme Court ended up deciding that a lot of the correspondence was considered proprietary information. I think it's important to point out that this isn't asking for data. It's not asking for research. It's not asking for research methods. It's asking for every scrap of paper, every handwritten note, every email, every lab book, every peer review comment, everything that goes into the research process. And so our concerns aren't necessarily with FOIA itself, but with the breadth of these kinds of requests. And so when we started looking into how this was used, we saw it went well beyond climate scientists. There were epidemiologists who worked on hog farms who had all of their research information and all of their emails and communications requested. There were lawyers who made comments about gay marriage cases. There were scientists who worked on everything from air pollution to public health to endangered species to mountaintop removal mining, dating back 20 years, who have received these kinds of requests. And as more and more communication happens over email between scientists, all one has to do is find the weakest link. So it's not as if researchers at Harvard have, there is a bit of a lack of level playing field there in that you can't request emails of the Harvard professor, but you can get at their emails by going to a more permissive state like Texas.
Also okay. Public and private.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, your view is that these are excessive, abusive. Is that right?
So in a lot of these cases, they are. And you know, I know that we're going to be talking a little bit about the genetically modified cases today. And you know, a lot of what's been discovered and has been reported on has been legitimate and should be disclosed. Things like scientists getting funding for outreach campaigns or getting funding for writing scientific papers. But our concern is with the breadth of these kinds of requests. They do take sometimes weeks to comply with, and you know, excessively broad FOIA requests end up drowning scientists in paperwork, intimidating their colleagues who may or may not have tenure or may be graduate students trying to get into a field, and ultimately taking them away from learning more about the world around us.
Well, there was one such story earlier this year about Willie Soon, correct?
Yeah, and
refresh our memory about that one.
Yeah, so Willie Soon is a researcher at the Smithsonian and Harvard Institute for Astrophysics. I'm not sure what he is. He's not a climate scientist. He's some kind of engineer, I believe.
Aerospace
engineer. He's written a lot on climate change from a very, very skeptical position, a lot about how the sun is causing it, that kind of thing.
Call them doubters.
I'll leave it up to you on what you want to call them, because I know that's a contentious topic as well. But I think that you know, in that case, the information that was disclosed by the Smithsonian was a fairly narrowly tailored amount of information about how a coal company, it was a utility company of some sort in the South that had created a relationship with Dr. Soon, where the company funded his research and then ended up having a kind of sign-off, more or less, over his eventual research products. They were able to view and comment on them before they went to press, and none of that was disclosed. And so that kind of that kind of information should be disclosed. It should be part of the public record. And you know, ultimately, I think the solutions to this won't be with individual FOIA laws in different states or with universities or the federal government. It'll be with figuring out how do we create disclosure standards for universities that allow us to see the information that we want to see and keep private the stuff we don't.
All right, well, hold that thought. We'll come back to that. Now, you also, in fact, you mentioned this, there have been some articles, there have been some news stories about revealing previously undisclosed evidence of collaboration, of ties, of support for scientists who are speaking out or being involved in GMO research.
Mm-hmm.
You've been somewhat critical of our fellow panelists here for having filed requests that prompted some of that news coverage, have you not?
Yes,
yeah.
And it wasn't.
Tell us what your problem is with what he did.
Yeah, so the concern is, you know, with the breadth of the request and how, you know, far we go in. And going over all of this information. You know, so if it was narrowly tailored to look at funding information and at influence and relationships between companies and researchers, then that would be one thing. But the way that we're put together, we felt was a bit too broad. Certainly the scientists felt that they were, you know, being targeted. Now, I think that it's important to point out that scientists, universities have disclosure rules that tend to be pretty conservative, and a lot of times they're not robust enough. And so the universities will say, well, we complied with all of these this disclosure rules, so there's no problem here. They give inadequate guidance to researchers when it comes to the sorts of information that they're supposed to disclose. And I think that as scientists are under more scrutiny than ever before, that they need to take more time and realize not only what are real conflicts of interest in terms of funding, but also where there can be perceived conflicts of interest. I also think there's a lot of conflation between that I've seen in some of the news coverage that's come out and in some of the writing on the Right to Know blog, that kind of suggests that, well, any discussion that a journalist or a scientist has with industry makes them suspect, makes them a stooge, makes them somehow corrupt. And I think we need to distinguish between what is actual influence and what is just conversation.
Okay, thank you. Gary Ruskin. Michael Halpern thinks you've gone too far. How many requests have you filed?
So we have filed probably, I think it's 43 requests from to about 22 universities regarding the work of food and agriculture and agrochemical companies and their PR firms and their corporate front groups and the work that the professors do with them. We've filed a number of other federal ones too, not having to do with professors. And for I've done public interest work my whole life, and so have probably have filed scores and scores of FOIAs.
So but dozens in this particular issue.
Yeah.
Why so many?
What's happening right now is the food industry is at a critical time in that people are fleeing from big food and big food's products, and so they have generated a very large PR campaign in defense of processed food, packaged food, GMOs, artificial sweeteners, artificial colors. And so we're talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars that are being spent on this PR campaign a year. And the industry understands that, in general, they have no credibility with the public. And so they need independent third-party scientists in order to speak for them.
Well,
and so,
but let me interrupt you for a second, though. How did you select these targets? I guess that's the question. Did you have information that they were somehow interacting with industry, or were they just taking views that were contrary to yours?
Different for different ones. Many of them are on the boards of directors of organizations that are plainly corporate front groups. Others have written for PR firm websites on these issues. So those are good examples. Others have written documents for political campaigns on these issues.
So you had some prior reason to pick these people. You
didn't for sure.
Do a fishing expedition.
Yeah.
Well, now, Michael Halpern says you should have limited your inquiries just to the financial ties of those individuals to industry. Is that a fair characterization of your position?
I mean, financial ties and, whether or not there are, what kind of influence that comes along with those ties, as well as, any sort of thing that could be perceived to have that kind of influence.
Okay, but you and you asked for more. You asked for emails.
Yeah. So I actually asked Union Concerned Scientists about one of our FOIAs, and I said, is this good enough? Is this too broad? And
you asked them for advice.
Yeah, I did.
Why?
Because they were highly critical of our work, and so I thought, I should ask and see if we can come up with some kind of agreement. And it turns out that, they essentially wrote back to me, Gresham Goldman did, and said, only ties that have strictly to do with financial matters are subject to what we think is legitimate. And so the net effect of that would have been that almost none of the news stories that we have gotten in, front page New York Times by a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, Eric Lipton, Boston Globe, Mother Jones, Bloomberg, and a bunch of others too, almost none of that would have happened had we followed the Union of Concerned Scientists policy. And so, so we would have had dramatically less information to work with. It's also, Michael's point of view is naive because the way these investigations work is oftentimes, like in the Willie Soon case, you have to ask questions, you have to FOIA repeatedly in order to find the information that you really need. So in the case of the Willie Soon case, I think they went through 3 or 4 iterations before they actually found the good stuff. And so, using your criteria, they never would have found the good stuff. And so, this is a very serious matter because there are serious kinds of wrongdoing that are uncovered with broad FOIAs of scientists, like pharmaceutical industry scandals and ghostwriting. And that kind of thing, if you miss it, there are a lot of lives at stake. And so that's why I think your position is really irresponsible.
Well, we'll explore that, and you'll get a chance to respond.
Perfect.
Mike Sorahan, you've actually used open records laws to do some reporting. You did some reporting here recently about a story of great interest in this community, I would think.
Yes,
tell
I
us
did.
About that.
I did. I've used FOIA use FOIA a lot, and among reporters, there's people who use more and people who use less, and I'm probably on the more side. In this case, it was really the first time that I can think of that I found myself filing FOIAs with a university press office, and that's really kind of an accident of the structure of government in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Geological Survey is part of the University of Oklahoma, even though it basically performs the role of a state agency. In a lot of states, the Geological Survey would be part of a cabinet agency like the Department of Natural Resources. The story, to kind of cut the chase on this, is about the earthquakes that are occurring in Oklahoma and their potential ties to and whether or not they're being caused by oil and gas activity, and particularly its disposal of wastewater. And disposal of wastewater can cause earthquakes when you have a very high volume of it. The water gets into the faults, changes the pressure, and they slip. In Oklahoma, being critical or finding fault with the oil and gas company, the oil and gas industry, is kind of a fraught proposition. It's, by different definitions, 1 in 5 jobs or so. But anyway, so in reporting on this, there was a lot of question as to whether industry might be playing a role in this or not, and the reaction was, look for the science.
Did you get a tip that prompted your request?
I wouldn't say it's anything as direct as a tip, so much as there were rumors that scientists, and in particular this scientist who was the geologist at OGS, named Austin Holland, that industry was trying to interfere and intimidate him and the agency. And I don't think that really surprised anybody. I mean, you can write, it probably been written any number of times that, it's difficult to criticize the industry in Oklahoma. It accounts for 1 in 5 jobs. It's a very big part of the economy of the state.
Sure, but what we're talking about here is science and a scientific determination.
Right.
They were being asked to determine whether the explosion of earthquakes, the hundreds of earthquakes that were happening here on a regular basis, were somehow tied to the oil and gas hydraulic fracturing, the disposal of the wastewater,
right,
injection into the ground. And initially, they were ambivalent at best about whether there was a direct tie or not, correct?
I think the industry basically said that there wasn't, there couldn't be. They weren't causing it. Essentially what we wound up finding was that when the Oklahoma Geological Survey and this scientist and his colleagues sort of started moving toward sort of agreeing with all these outside scientists and saying, yes, there is some connection with the industry and disposal, this particular scientist was called to a pretty high-level meeting in realms that he's not used to meeting in. He was called to the office of the president of the university, David Boren, where he was to meet with pretty much the richest oil man, most powerful oil man in the state, which is Harold Hamm, for coffee. That was an email. That was one email in a big stack. Said he told someone, I have to go meet with Harold Hamm in David Boren's office for coffee. And his colleague said, well, gosh, I guess that's better than having Kool-Aid. But that, I think there had been a lot of there was a general notion that it would be hard to criticize the industry in Oklahoma, but that kind of put a very much of a face on it. There's more to it than that, but that's the essence of it.
And wasn't, I don't know if this was part of your story with the emails, but had not Harold Hamm made it known or said, whether in jest or not, that he would like to clean house?
It's not in jest.
Geologic Survey after they took that position?
It was a different story. It was by Bloomberg, a very good story. In this case, that was a conversation between Mr. Hamm and the dean of the college. And again, this is all intertwined. The College of Energy and Geology includes the School of Geology, but also Oklahoma Geological Survey. So this dean is over an academic school and a State Department. And he was called, I don't really know why he was at the Continental. Mr. Hamm runs Continental Resources, which has a fairly large building downtown. It's the second largest building downtown. He was there meeting with Mr. Hamm. During this meeting, President Boren walked out because I believe there was a Continental board meeting that day. And President Boren serves on the board of Continental. He makes about as much doing that as he does being president of the university. And yes, so the dean, his name is Larry Grillot, later jots down in a conversation, in a memo to one of his colleagues that, yes, Mr. Hamm said that he is irritated enough at what people at OGS have been saying that he would like certain people at OGS dismissed, Oklahoma Geological Survey dismissed. No, and it was not in jest.
And this was around the same time as the coffee break.
Yeah, it's actually 9 months later.
Right. But while this issue was still brewing.
Yes.
Yes.
If you'd like to see it, I have a 400-line spreadsheet of the entire timeline. But
okay.
I doubt you want to see it.
One last story, and we'll deal with this one quickly. You also wrote a piece based also on FOIA emails about the university seeking, preparing to seek a gift from Mr. Hamm.
Yes.
At the same time all this was happening, correct?
Yeah, after Bloomberg burned me on that one, and props to him, I kept doing some digging and found that, yes, during this period of time, the dean, Larry Grillot, was part of a group that was trying to get $25 million from Mr. Hamm for a new energy school building.
Okay. All right. So, we've laid out the various sides of the issue here. We have a scientist who's on the receiving end of this. Okay, well, let's go back to this for a minute. How did this affect your life, getting this? You said it was more of a statement of accusation, but also a demand to paw through your papers. What did that do? Did it prevent you from, how many hours did you spend on that personally?
A lot. A lot of hours making sure that we got all the information they needed, and probably even more hours worrying about it.
Really?
Yes. Because of the tenor of the accusations. So it's really interesting because we've listened to this, broad cross-section of perspectives, and this is clearly not a black and white issue. FOIAs are clearly necessary. They're clearly an important tool. They're a way to get at information that people need to know that would not otherwise be available, but they can also be misused as a weapon for no good purpose except clearly to threaten and intimidate. And my reaction to what I received, and those of my colleagues who I also spoke with who are also on the receiving end, was very much, we got the message loud and clear. The message was, sit down and shut up or you'll be sorry. That was the message that we were being given by means of this FOIA.
And did you?
No.
did anybody at your university suggest to you that you should because you were bringing trouble to the university?
Yes.
They did?
Yes.
Somebody who could control your career?
People who were giving friendly advice. They meant it well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you take it as friendly advice or as an implied threat?
I took it as friendly advice. There were other types of more negative things, but the advice to stop, so to speak, foul in your own backyard came from people who really were like, you know what, you're a good scientist, just sit down and do your good science work. Keep your head down.
Okay. But did it prevent you from doing your work?
In the receipt of those different FOIAs, absolutely, because all of those hours spent were hours that you couldn't spend doing the research that you're being paid to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Michael, you wanted to respond a little bit to...
Yeah, sure. I think there's a few points there. The Willie Soon case itself was absolutely tied to money. It was the funding agreement that came with the money that the Smithsonian Institution was receiving based on what those conditions were. So I don't quite see the parallel there.
Let me ask you a question, though, Michael. Yeah. Do you think Willie Soon felt like he was being harassed?
I think he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think he might have lost some sleep over that, too?
I'm sure he did.
Okay.
And
should he have?
Should he have? I think that scientists all the time are completely unprepared for these kinds of attacks, no matter who they are. We were very careful in our reporting of the case not to go after him specifically, but to talk about how inappropriate these kinds of agreements are. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be made public. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't come forward. I mean, I also file FOIAs on a fairly regular basis. I have one sitting at a federal agency right now that just this week they asked for another extension, which was really frustrating. We do it as a matter of course, and I think there is a difference between the agency work and the university work. Agencies are there to make policy. Universities are generally there to make knowledge that informs that policy, and those are two different things. I think you also need to look at what is done with this kind of information. In addition to turning on individual scientists, you can turn on other people that people communicate with. So Catherine spoke earlier about the communication between journalists and university scientists. Right to Know has gone after the same sorts of things and published something a couple weeks ago on their website, a short report on journalists mentioned in our FOIA requests. There was a question that I think came from Gary to Tamara Haspel with the Washington Post, asking her how much money she received from industry. She replied something to the effect on Twitter that said, since everyone who entertains the idea that genetically modified foods could be, could have some benefit for the world, then I've received plenty of information, plenty of support. Then the screaming headline from his group is, on September 23rd, Washington Post food columnist Tamara Haspel admitted to receiving plenty of money from pro-agrochemical industry sources. What she was talking about was support by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for various panels she had been on, smoking gun here on her was that she had been pitched on some stories, that she had received emails, and that some of those pitches had actually worked.
Okay.
So it's a little bit unclear as to where the money comes from.
Do you think it's pertinent that, was the Gates Foundation money so that she could appear on panels and talk about GMOs?
I'd have to turn to Gary to talk about what that money was specifically for. But my understanding from what she's put forward is that, she hasn't received any specific money herself, that it's right. Actually just they're supporting events at which she is speaking or supporting other people who are pitching things to her.
Oh, so you're understanding that she was not paid anything?
She's not going out there and receiving $10,000 for a speaking engagement. There's no buck raking here.
Or being paid to fly there and speak or whatever. Well, let's ask Gary. You're the one who filed the FOIA. So, what did the documents actually reveal about this report? This is one we wanted to get into. Obviously, we got a few journalists here. They might be a little touchy about that.
We did not file. We have never filed any FOIAs about journalists, and we've never used journalists as search terms. But Tamara Haspel was one of the journalists who came up anyway. What we have found was that she gave a talk to conference, a pro-GMO conference that was designed to teach scientists how to spread pro-GMO messaging. And it was run by two key front groups for the agrochemical industry, one called Academics Review, another one called the Genetic Literacy Project, along with the University of Florida, which has received millions and millions and millions of dollars from the agrochemical industry. So that's one of the things she did. She did another talk.
But was there any evidence that she got paid to do that, or that her travel expenses were covered?
I've asked her. She has not responded.
Okay. So the main piece of information you have there is that she appeared at this event that was sponsored by these institutions.
And she says that she gets paid for these talks.
And she's spoken out, written favorably about GMO foods and their safety.
Repeatedly writes columns in support of genetically engineered food.
Well, I mean, and some of the other emails that you found in this request that wasn't specifically about journalists was that some of them had been copied on communications with industry types.
Yeah,
and one of them was even referred to as a friend in one email. Right.
Like one of the emails was about a guy named Keith Clore, who's pretty much the agrochemical industry's favorite reporter, and so. So one of the emails, had essentially the agrochemical industry's favorite PR person, a guy named John Entine, calling Keith Clore a very good friend. So,
but of course, he wasn't actually acknowledging that or involved in this at all. So
absolutely,
whether
not.
He's a friend or not is another matter. And if he said he had very little contact with him,
all we have is the evidence that we have.
Yeah, but that was pretty limited information. Is that right?
It's suggestive of a broader picture of Keith Clore's work, which is that time and time again, the guy speaks glowingly of the agrochemical industry and defends it time and time again, and has also done a lot of work to try to undermine our FOIA project.
Well, let's take a couple of points here for a second. Mm-hmm. We're journalists. It's our job. Let me correct me if I'm wrong, Mike. It's our job to talk to everybody. Does it demonstrate that I'm somehow in bed with the food industry if I call Monsanto and ask them to explain their position? Am I in bed with them if I ask them for contacts, for background, even for tips on what their latest research is finding?
Of course not.
So if they take out of that I'm a friendly journalist and they say in an email that I'm a friend, does that make me their friend?
It's a piece of evidence.
Right.
All it is what it says.
I got you.
But it's a piece of context within a much broader picture of his years of work making incorrect statements about genetically engineered food.
I guess what I'm sort of getting at here in a way is, isn't it that the emails, the documents we get from a FOIA aren't necessarily, maybe Mike, you can answer this question. When you get documents from a FOIA, is that the end of the story, the end of the reporting?
Absolutely not.
What do you do with them once you get them?
After a number of other processes, a number of other aspects, and probably spending a long time reading them, you start making phone calls. You can't, it's always better to have talked to somebody in the end rather than just read, an email that you're getting as a search term, that's a slice of 1 minute of their life.
Right. Well, of course, Michael has suggested, I guess, that you shouldn't, we shouldn't, and maybe journalists as well, activists and journalists both, shouldn't be so quick to file FOIAs that we can get our information other ways.
No, I mean, I think it's not an either-or situation. I think that FOIA is important. I think that we should continue to file FOIAs until there is a better disclosure mechanism in place, and still they will be helpful.
But didn't you write in a recent blog that shouldn't be the first line of inquiry that one makes?
I don't think that's true, and I don't think I've written that. I think
maybe I misunderstood that in the October 9th blog.
That, we need to make sure that FOIAs are construed in a way that balances both the public's right to know and the scientist's ability to do his or her job, and that we need to be careful, the journalists need to be careful to take things with a grain of salt. I mean, I'm not sure if you shopped around those smoking gun emails from the reporters or that copied reporters on email, but was that something that you did and didn't get bites on, or why did you decide to put it on your specific website?
Well, the reason really was that Tamar Haspel wrote that the tweet to me, and then she wouldn't respond with any further information about the money. So I just thought that you know, I would just knock it out the door quickly.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is maybe a question any of you can take a pop at here, but isn't it sort of human nature that we tend to want to talk to and associate with people who agree with our views? And isn't there also a distinction between a journalist and a columnist or an editorial writer? I mean, maybe you don't know that. Mike, what do you, you're the journalist. Is there a distinction in our world between one and the other?
No, I would.
A reporter and a columnist?
I would think so, yeah.
Okay.
Certainly you're more entitled to have an opinion, and
all right.
Over time you make it clear that, you know, if you're writing about GMOs, that you're a supporter of GMOs, and hopefully your audience would kind of get into that or would understand that over time.
Well, let's take a pause here. And we've got starting to get some people lined up here. Part of our process here is to let the audience ask questions, because they're a bunch of journalists too. And I'll come back with maybe one last question here at the end to try to wrap it up. But the ground rules are journalists and SCJ members get to ask the first questions. Once they're exhausted, other members in the audience may do so. It must be a question. Please make it a brief one, and no long-winded statements. Thank you. We have two lines up here. We'll start here. All right, with Dr. Bornstein.
Oh, at the danger, I feel sort of like this question is sort of like being defending Larry Flint when I'm in, you know, supporting with the questions of the Gary, his FOIAs, because Keith Clore, by the way, he's being slimed here, is one of the best science journalists around, and is basically reflecting the mainstream science of GMOs, but we're not getting to that. So my question for Catherine is, and if Michael, if you want, in general, when I file a FOIA as a journalist, first off, they never answer on time, so I want to know how long it took you to answer, because, you know, EPA, I waited 4 years, and, you know, so I'm wondering why you didn't do, you know, the EPA way. Second, in the FOIA law, if these are, as you think, you know, nasty FOIAs, just for the sake of suppressing your work, there is something that makes pay for your time. And the time of copying, the cost of copying, the time of compiling. So, do any universities do this, or is this just a stupid federal government thing? And isn't that one thing to do? You know, every time Gary FOIAs, why not ask him to pay for your time?
That was kind of a multi-part question. You want to take the
I'm
first
sorry.
Couple pieces? Yeah. How long did it take you? Should I repeat the question?
No.
Everybody.
I have short answers to both.
Okay.
On the time frame, our university complied within the first requested deadline. Yes, and one time they filed, so ATI filed a complaint against our university through the Attorney General's office saying that the university did not comply with the first time frame. They said that they had faxed a request just before Christmas. Well, that fax never arrived, and the university had proof it never arrived. So, but they had to respond to the AG's office. And so their main motivation was to get the AG out of their hair. And so there was no charging for my time. They might have charged for their time. They are lawyers. And there was no non-compliance of any type. It was immediate.
How much time? How many weeks before your response?
Oh, it was whatever the date was in the fax that was first received. It was there by that exact time.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have, just briefly,
oh,
we have
ahead.
50 states with 50 different FOIA laws. They're all implemented differently. Mm-hmm. At this point, if you're a scientist in a controversial field or a contentious field, you might as well consult a lawyer before you take a job, because you don't know how it's going to work at your institution in your state. Thank you for speaking up and defending Keith Clore. Nothing that he has written has ever, you know, to my knowledge, anything on this issue has ever been repudiated as being incorrect or in any of that regard.
If I could just respond to that for a second.
Go ahead, briefly.
He's written three stories just about our FOIAs packed with factual inaccuracies, and anybody who wants to just read them with me, I'm happy to run through them.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Sarah Terry Cobo with the Journal Record newspaper. Dr. Hayho, I have a quick question for you. Has your experience changed the way you do email?
Yes. In fact, on the advice of our lawyers, it definitely has changed. Most of us scientists aren't big on phones or texting, and we have no water cooler in our department. But it has definitely made us more conscious of the fact that, at least in Texas, everything that is written down electronically is open to FOIA. And that was something that I or my colleagues were aware of before that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mike, you wanted to throw something in?
I'd just say it's just being a requester has made me change the way I do email, too.
All right. Over here.
Lizzie Grossman, freelance, based in Portland, Oregon. And my question is largely for Michael Halpern. I've been doing a lot of stories that involve conflict of interest issues, and quite a lot of them do not necessarily involve financial arrangements. Sometimes people are employed by places, but that is a little bit different than asking for money. But there are a lot of other conflict of interests and influence, I don't know how to say it, sort of impositions of influence that can happen without mm-hmm. financial transactions. Mm-hmm. Why would you limit an inquiry, whether it's FOIA or any other, to financial transactions if there are other ways that influence can be pushed and peddled?
So I will readily admit.
Can everybody hear the question? Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I will readily admit that there is a gray middle that we haven't necessarily, as a community, figured out yet. I think that it is important for us to be able to root out all kinds of conflict of interest. For example, if a company writes a scientist testimony and they go deliver that testimony before a state legislature, that should be disclosed. And there's several places where that disclosure could happen. The company could, obviously the company is probably not going to disclose that. But the state legislature should be requiring that a scientist disclose, where that influence came from. That may not happen either. The university should disclose where that came from. That may not happen either. So I think we need to figure out ways that FOIA can be used to get at that kind of influence, and that scientists should be, given enough information so that they know what should be disclosed and what should not. But it's really difficult, It's really difficult to root that information out. And scientists do talk to all sorts of people when they're, Catherine, I'm assuming, has testified before different bodies and has sought input from, different players. Is that correct?
ExxonMobil paid for half of my master's degree.
Okay, so where should she disclose that? Should that be on her faculty website? Should that be something that she writes at the end of every paper? Should she say that, go through that long list of people who have helped her along the way when she comes and speaks at this kind of event? How do we work that? How do we manage that? We haven't answered those questions yet. So it's a great question. We don't have all the answers, and we'll need the help of the journalism community to get there.
Can I just respond to that just for a quick second?
Briefly, yep.
Okay, so this question is so important because we are finding conflicts of interest that also have nothing to do at all with direct financial contributions. Like, for example, we had a Boston Globe piece last week about a professor, Harvard professor named Calestous Juma, who's largely funded by the Gates Foundation. But and the Gates Foundation works closely with the agrochemical industry, but it's a different entity, different entities, obviously. But takes the money from the Gates Foundation, and then a Monsanto executive essentially ordered this Harvard professor to write a paper, told him approximately what the title should be in a paragraph, with what the paper should contain, and the Harvard professor did it.
Talking points, in essence.
Yeah, in essence, that's right, and he followed it completely.
Okay.
So again, but this is not a scientific paper. This is something he wrote that was consistent with his views on a pro-GMO website as a policy paper.
Is that not fair?
And it wasn't necessarily an ordered sort of thing. It was like, here are some things that I think would be helpful for us to share through this website. So where's the beef?
So, but well, who cares if it's a scientific paper or not? People read it. And,
all right.
And,
yeah. All right. Hold on. Do you think that was inappropriate to be asking for that kind of information?
I think that it is not necessarily inappropriate to ask professors to share information and to write things up. I think it's incumbent upon the...
Is it inappropriate for us to publicize that?
No. I mean, I think it's good for... and it's good for scientists to be able to disclose this. Something like that, you know, can come out in a fairly narrowly tailored Freedom of Information Act request.
I see.
We want to see communication on these articles that is not that is not science. This is not the conduct of science. This is one person writing their personal opinion about a science policy related issue.
Policy issue, sure. Question here. Mike, I'll get back to you. Yeah, go ahead.
Joe Davis, I edit the SCJ's Watchdog newsletter about freedom of information stuff. Question, hopefully to as many as can answer, what are the solutions? What are the standards? How do we fix this? It's clearly a conflict.
Let's start with, who wants to go first? Three sentences. Make it as quick as possible.
The solution is you. If there are people who are abusing the FOIA, you should write about them.
Okay. Next. Catherine.
As a scientist, national standards that we all understand and are taught from day one. We move around. Academics move around. Every state is totally different. We don't even know what we're dealing with, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. It's really tough.
You need counseling, advice, guidance.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Michael.
And those standards need to be enforceable, too. We need to figure out a way that there is a level playing field across all institutions, across all disciplines that can come in through, for example, the National Science Foundation or NIH funding. The institutions they fund should be required to both adhere to and enforce specific standards. That's the best way I've been able to figure it out.
Mike, do you have some ideas?
This topic, I don't really see the... I don't see the problem, so I understand that it's not always pleasant. And, I mean, I think a lot of the problems that we're talking about here are, say, an ideological attorney general or a court case, more so than FOIA, which is, I just kind of hearing that open records requests, and I understand your story, but on the other side of the open records request, it often seems very difficult and time-consuming also.
So FOIAs don't kill people. Doubters do. Is that it?
large corporate subpoenas kill people.
I see. Let's see. Over here.
Hi, Mike.
We got time for one more question.
Mike Lee with Energy Wire. And this is a question for Dr. Hale and Michael Halpern. Most scientific research goes through a rigorous process, peer review, back and forth, things like that. Isn't this sort of public scrutiny, whether it's from a reporter or from an interest group, isn't it just an extension of that? Review process? I mean,
in my case, it certainly wasn't. They weren't interested in my research. They could not care less about my research. They were interested in me speaking up publicly, saying that climate change is real, and whether I was telling people and whether I was working with organizations or people who would tell other people. If I could publish 1 million articles till the cows come home in the geophysical research, and they wouldn't care. They only care if it goes outside the ivory tower, and so it is completely different from peer review, at least in the experience of myself and every colleague I spoke to who was FOIA'd by the same organization.
Let me rephrase the question.
Yeah.
Shouldn't the public have a right to sort of scrutinize how you present your research in public?
Well, but again, it was not presenting my research. It was saying that my field is real. It was saying climate science is not astrology. Okay. That was it. That was the only thing they had the problem with.
Michael?
Okay. Well, I mean, and this is where I'll cut in for the final question, and it's sort of a quick for each of you to follow up on his question. Should peer review comments, should your notes, should your drafts be fair game for folks to see whether your research, your published research was actually credible?
Well, here's the thing. What I was taught in graduate school was that when you publish a paper, you include every detail in that paper that would allow your research to be reproduced by another scientist. So no matter who that scientist is, what language they speak, where they're from, who they vote for, they should be able to pick up your journal article and reproduce it, and that is the goal. And now we're even talking about massive data archives to accompany each paper, which is crazy in a world that has terabytes of data, but that's what we're talking about, is entire data archives too. So the goal of scientific publishing is to archive all the information needed to recreate what's been done. And in fact, we just published a paper, Rasmus Benestad was our lead author, but we just published a paper a month ago where we took 38 journal articles that had been published by Willie Soon and others, leading to conclusions that humans were not causing climate, and we recreated the calculations of those 38 papers to determine where, in fact, the errors were, and if you corrected them, how different the results would be. So we could do that because we took the time to do it as a scientist.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
How do we fix this? Do we fix this? Can we change open records laws? How do we make that them so that we can protect academic freedom and still have accountability?
We can't go state by state. We can't fix 50 different state laws. And we also can't let transparency turn into an arms race between people who are looking to damage scientists they don't trust. So we need to, build awareness about how these records laws are used and misused and what information people are going for, so that the public doesn't get duped, so the journalists don't get duped. You know, now you see the reporting on scientists' emails a lot different than it was in 2010 and 2009 after sort of the whole ClimateGate scandal,
sure.
Where a lot of people, were kind of a little bit under appreciative of how these things can go by. The interest is not in science, it's in, trying to play gotcha.
Thank you. Gary, so is the solution here more disclosure, not less?
I think that the solution here is the status quo, and it works pretty well. And some people, there is certainly some abuse of the FOIA, and you're an awesome example of how awful that can be. But at the same time, the FOIA is a crucial tool for uncovering wrongdoing and crimes, and is a vital tool for saving lives via public health and environmental standards. And we should keep it the way it is.
Mike, last word.
Actually, I think FOIA in general and in most states should be changed to, toward more openness. But and that's independent of this entire debate.
That's a whole different topic, and we'll get to that another day. There you've had it. This is a topic that we could spend a much longer time exploring in greater depth, and I'm sure you would also have some more good questions. But I hope this will give you a taste, and now we're going to have a little housekeeping. Thank you, Brent. Let's have a hand for the panel.